Good morning, everybody. For the record, my name is Rex Kim, Chief Investment Officer of the Oregon State Treasury. Before proceeding with today's meeting, I would like to make a few comments about our format. First, please note that today's meeting is being recorded, and the audio portion along with materials will be posted on the Treasury website. Next, there is a closed captioning option available. You can click on the screen symbol at the bottom of the window to turn on this feature. Next, if you're having any technical difficulties, you can type a question into the Ask a Question box on the right side of your screen. Our IT team is on standby to respond. Last but very importantly, in regards to public comments, you will need to submit those via writing. You could use either the same Ask a Question box, or you could send it to us at any time via email or regular mail. We are always very appreciative of these public comments, and so we would encourage you to connect with us. Lastly, thank you to everyone participating, everyone listening in. We thank you for your patience, your feedback, and we'll continue to make refinements to this format so that these meetings are a good use of your time. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Chair Russell.
Thank you, Rex. This is John Russell, the Chair of the Investment Council, and I'd like to call the meeting to order. You'll hear that's the gavel. I'd like to start with a roll call of council members. Please signify by saying aye when I call your name. Ms. Samples?
Aye.
Ms. Moss? Yeah, she had called me before having technical difficulties. So the treasurer and I are here in Tigard. So the first order of business, is the review and approval of the minutes. There's some technical difficulties here.
John, this is Patty.
Good. So
I'm on the phone because I couldn't get in through Teams.
Okay.
And this is Kevin Olenek. I'm on too. I couldn't get through Teams.
Okay, good. So the record will show that Ms. Moss is present.
Kevin Olenek here too. I'm present. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. So the first order of business is to review and approve the minutes of April 22nd. Do I hear a motion?
Approval of minutes.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second.
This is Patricia. I'll second. Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Good. Rex, committee reports.
All righty. Well, Chair Russell and members of the council, I'm going to keep my comments very brief today because we have a very full agenda, an agenda I'm pretty excited about. To start off with, we are very fortunate to be joined today by Greg Jensen. He is co-CIO at Bridgewater. He will be providing for us some of Bridgewater's thoughts on our current market environment. Obviously, we've been impacted quite a bit by COVID-19, and markets have come back nicely, but still there are probably some lingering issues to be discussed. Post that portion of the agenda, we'll move into a couple of the action items. We have two items today. The first one is the asset allocation and capital markets assumptions. And then after that, we have some fixed income manager recommendations as well. The other thing I did want to say, as a CIO, I wanted to pay extra tribute to the members of the council. We have kept the council members this month extremely busy with a lot of committee activity. So I wanted to be very clear with everyone that you guys have gone above and beyond, and I just wanted to note that we are very appreciative of it. So, in regards to committee activity And this is a long list, starting with the Private Equity Committee. The committee approved $250 million to Thoma Bravo Fund 14, 150 million euros to Vitruvian Investment Partners 4, 325 million euros to CVC Capital Partners 8, 100 million to Sherpa Healthcare Fund 1. The Alternatives Portfolio Committee approved $150 million to NGP Realty Partners. The Real Estate Committee approved the following as well, $250 million to Abacus Core Multifamily Separate Accounts, $150 million to Columbia Industrial Properties LLC, and finally, $150 million to Sculptor Real Estate Fund 4 LP. And with that, Chair Russell, I'll turn it back to you.
And are you going to introduce our speaker, Rex?
So with that, I will ask Joel Whidden from Bridgewater to make the introduction and launch us off into the market environment piece.
Thank you, Rex. Thank you, Chair Russell. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. We're thrilled to be joining the OIC meeting this morning and honored to manage money on behalf of the Oregon system. First, let me briefly introduce Greg and myself. Greg Jensen, as Rex mentioned, is one of our co-chief investment officers and a 24-year veteran of the firm. I think actually 25 if you include Greg's internship while he was a student at Dartmouth. So a long history with the firm. My name is Joel Whidden. I'm a 19-year veteran of the firm. I head up our global marketing efforts, and I'm the lead on the Oregon client team that services the relationship. Many of you may have remembered, but my colleague Jim Haskell and I were in front of you back in January presenting our all-weather strategy. Thank you so much for deciding to invest and including all-weather in your risk parity allocation. Very much appreciate that. At the time, I gave sort of a lengthy introduction to the firm, so maybe I'll spend just a minute before I pass off to Greg to take you through our thoughts on the current environment, the impact of the virus, and the road ahead. So to summarize in just a moment, I sort of think of the three key hallmarks of Bridgewater, one being a lot of experience, so 45 years at this stage managing money and sharing our insights with clients on economies and markets. Second, consistency of people, process, and culture, the things I believe lead to the long-term success of any company, whether they're a money manager or another kind of business. A level below that, our CIOs and senior investors have worked together for decades to build out a deep understanding for how economies and policy and markets work and interact, and they're constantly improving on that understanding. The cultural piece, I think, is critical as well. In our own case, our culture is focused on creating a meritocracy of ideas, having very open and honest conversation. Ray Dalio, our founder, refers to it as radical truth and radical transparency, identifying our mistakes and trying to fix those as quickly as we can, constant learning and constant improving. And then I think the last thing, before I pass to Greg, is our goal of having sort of bespoke strategic partnerships with our largest clients, where the goal is to be a true thought partner, engaging on our clients' highest priorities across a range of topics, whether that's on economies and markets, much like the conversation Greg's going to have with you today, sharing lessons learned through managing money and managing an organization to invest money over the last 45 years, whether it's on things like managing cybersecurity, managing data and technology, or the transition to work from home, as we've all gone through more recently with the virus. And last, on portfolio construction, and there are a couple of recent cases we're going to engage with your investment team later this month on that I think may bring that to base. One involves us helping model your portfolio and cash flows and sort of stress testing the liquidity profile of the fund through the sort of the last 100 years of events, to understand the nature of how those play out over time, and then the second one, to share our thoughts on measuring the alignment of individual companies and equities to ESG or sustainable investing principles, to name a couple. But that's all I had up front. Any questions organizationally before I hand off to Greg? All right, Greg, it's all you.
Great, thanks. Thank you very much. Thanks, Joel, and thanks, everybody, for spending some time with us. I wanted to describe kind of how we see the world today and what we would be thinking about in your shoes of what the big things to consider as you think through the right way to be invested for the next decade. Before the pandemic, we were worried about this decade, and particularly recognizing that this decade was likely to be very different than the decade that preceded it, because the challenges facing markets and economies in the developed world are major and secular. Most importantly, among many challenges, are A, the level of debts in the developed world. There are too many IOUs, if you take debts plus other promises of governments, relative to the incomes available to fund those. There's also limited monetary policy effectiveness. We've gone through 40 years of a monetary cycle bringing interest rates from the 1980s down to zero that has created more debt and allowed policymakers through the central bank to essentially offset every downturn. We're at the limits of monetary policy as an offset, and we'll talk about the implications of that. And there, in part, because of the economic backdrop and for a lot of other reasons as well, there's been growing internal and external conflict. Internal divisions as the winners and losers get separated and you have the worst wealth divide since the 1930s. And simultaneously, globally, a classic dynamic is a rising power growing to become a world power and threaten essentially the existing world power. And every time that occurs, that's a dangerous time for global economy and the world. And at the same time, growth was likely going to be too weak to help rise all ships. So the conflict gets worse when growth is weak. So we had those challenges before the pandemic. And really, we thought policymakers would need to become to adjust to those dynamics and shift over a decade towards a much more active fiscal policy that was merged with monetary policy because central banks had very limited effectiveness. And basically what COVID did was take what we thought was going to play out over a decade and had it happen over a couple of months. So you've seen a merger because you had the most extreme global income shock in history. If you take everywhere in the world, revenues of corporations dropped somewhere on the order of, you know, between 30 and 50%. And that created a 33% of GDP shock to the economy with interest rates already at zero, so very little for central banks to be able to do, which has required a new merger of monetary policy and fiscal policy. If you look across the world, that's what's happening in as everywhere that they can. They're printing a lot of money to finance a surging budget deficit to try to close the hole caused by the virus in terms of the revenue shortfall. Now, policymakers have taken those steps. Markets have reacted to the movement in liquidity and the movement in fiscal policy. But going forward, it's very dangerous. We think markets have gotten somewhat overly optimistic relative to the risks that are ahead, which are second and third order consequences. Corporates are going to exit this with much worse balance sheets than they entered it. CapEx plans have already collapsed. The global problems are going to remain. And of course, there's the risk of the virus, second waves and other things coming along. And so when we think about that policy of MP3, we think it's going to continue well past the crisis. You're going to have fiscal policy that's like nothing we've seen since World War II, and monetary policy moving to a totally different dynamic, essentially teaming up with fiscal to allow the government policy to occur for the most part. Now, we think that's necessary, but it also will likely be pushed to an extreme where eventually the most dangerous point will come when it becomes revealed that policymakers can't necessarily get what they want through monetary and fiscal policy. So printing money to make up for lost income. The more you do that, the more you press on inflation, and we believe there's a good chance that we're moving from a 40-year deflationary period to creating the policies that will create a reflation inflationary period that'll have big implications for most portfolios. Can we go to the next page? So this page describes the mechanics at work. Now, I won't take you through it all, but I'd just say the main thing is this downturn is different, requiring a new type of policy response. Specifically, usually past recessions were caused when the Fed raised interest rates, credit dropped, and then that flowed through to lower incomes. Today, it was a direct income hit that led to less purchases. So if you look at this formula, this is all the sources in the world can be boiled down, sources of money in the world can be boiled down to money, credit, or income. And all the uses, all that money goes into either purchasing goods and services, which is the S, purchasing financial assets, or putting money on reserve with the central bank. When you look at what happened, incomes collapsed, and now the government's trying to make up for the income collapse by essentially borrowing money in the fiscal case and handing that to households. And they're trying to print money so that that borrowing that the government's doing isn't withdrawing liquidity from financial markets. Can we go to the next page, please? So to understand this world, in our view, you have to be able to understand the hole that's been created and what are the second and third order consequences of that hole and how is policy filling those holes. So this table goes through our calculations. We measure the economy down to every company in the world and back up to what that means for the macro picture. And today, if you go company by company, sector by sector, and then back up to the aggregate, you say, well, how much have corporations missed out on revenue as a result of the pandemic and the shutdowns and the lost income, that cycle? What you see here in the top left is $25 trillion, 33% of global GDP, will likely be lost out because of what's going on in terms of revenue. In the U.S., that's about $5.2 trillion of lost revenue. So then you start thinking, well, how are corporations dealing with that? To some extent, they're cutting labor costs. So essentially across the world, there's been a cut in labor costs. We think about $3.6 trillion for corporations. That's firing people. Obviously, the governments need to deal with that. Then you have capital expenditures that are going to be cut. We think there's about $3 trillion in global capital expenditures that are being cut. That's going to ripple through the global economy for years to come. Buybacks, M&A, and dividends are massively cut, $1.5 trillion. So you're going to leave, and even with all those cuts, companies still need $1.8 trillion in capital, which they'll get from borrowing and diluting their equity through issuing equity shares, and to some extent through bankruptcies, those losses will be taken care of. So that's what we're looking at. That's a huge problem, probably the most significant macroeconomic problem that's had to be dealt with by policymakers, faster and greater declines in these numbers than even in the Great Depression, although that lasted longer, so the numbers cumulatively became bigger. But that's what we're facing. And the things that'll matter in the world is, well, who ends up taking those losses? How much do corporates take the losses? How much do governments take the losses under their balance sheet? How much do households take the losses in terms of less wages and less jobs? So let's go to the next page. And this starts to illustrate what's happening in the U.S. case, but across, we'll go through it in every country in the world, of how policy is trying to deal with that massive loss in revenue for corporations. So in the U.S. case, there's a $5.2 trillion hit that somebody has to take. And the policy debate, while it's happening on many levels, is basically who takes it. And what you've seen is the U.S. government so far has decided to fill the hole for households. So if you look in the middle part, the hole for households, actually with everything the government's done, including increasing unemployment benefits, increasing the direct payments to making direct payments to everybody under $150,000. What you've actually done is, in the short term, we've filled the hole for households. In fact, households likely have about $656 billion more on in total than they would have had otherwise. But that's coming from the government taking on a $2.1 trillion hit as they've helped the households and helped corporations, and corporations having about a $3.6 trillion hit from this. So the balance sheets will leave this much worse than they entered it, with the government taking on some of that balance sheet instead of just having it sit on corporates and households. That's provided a little bit more sustainability, a little more ability to rebound than you would have had otherwise. But you still have a major lingering impact on corporations. And depending on what the government chooses to do, basically the money going to households runs out around the end of June, in some cases the end of July in others, that while the economy will still be at a terrible level and the second order consequences of corporate cutbacks will still be going through the economy, if there's not another major fiscal wave, households will start to see a significant deterioration in their cash available. So these are the big deal things to monitor. Can we go to the next page?
John Russell, if I may interrupt. As you've been speaking, I'm trying to look at all of this data through the eyes of, through a lens of inflation. And, boy, there's some powerful reasons to expect inflation, powerful reasons to expect deflation. What's your opinion?
Right.
Where do we go?
So you're right that both of those things are true. The powerful reasons for deflation are the fact that you have this big drop in demand and these conditions that are deflationary. At the same time, you continue to have a technological advancement that's by and large deflationary. But I would say, I think, the outcome in the end will probably prove to be inflationary. So the short-term hit's been deflationary. The longer-term hit, because A, this has affected both demand and supply. When people are allowed to go back to restaurants, they're going to find a lot of them closed. They're going to find, with social distancing and whatever, a lot less opportunities to go to places they want to go. Prices will likely rise. On top of that, just the natural outcome of the Fed deciding to print money to allow the government to run a budget deficit that's probably going to be about 15 to 17% of GDP, and if they don't get what they want, they will just do more in all likelihood. In the U.S., you might see some political friction in that regard, but by and large, the trend is established in my mind that in our minds that you're going to go down this path of monetary policy three, which is the combination of fiscal policy with money printing, until you get constrained. And the only constraint on that is inflation, is currency weakness and inflation. So I do think that's a higher risk. Of course, if policymakers don't do anything, you could have a deflationary outcome, more Japanification of the U.S. and Europe, and a deflationary impact. But I do think that's less likely than essentially policymakers using the opportunity to print money and spend it, and that's – no matter who's elected president in the next election, I expect that they'll be pushing in that direction, although in different ways, and that's the likely outcome, that we're probably near the end of the 40-year disinflationary wave, and that's a big deal. We'll get back to more of that a little later in the conversation.
If I may make another comment about that, isn't it true that printing money and having inflation is a pretty efficient way for the government to pay off its debt efficiently?
Exactly. It's all the only way. So the first way you make debt easier to pay off is you lower interest rates. When interest rates get to zero, the only real path is quantitative easing, is that A, the government paying itself by the central bank buying the bonds, in which case it doesn't matter because all the debt goes into the Fed, but the Fed makes all of its interest payments return to the government. So the first step is QE. And then when the QE has flattened the yield curve, the next step is to have inflation, which allows real yields to fall further, which is technically, in our view, somewhat necessary, and it's the likely outcome. And basically that will allow for the debtors in the world, which we think there's too much debt and too many promises, to move forward. And your choices are largely some inflation making real rates more negative, allowing debtors to make their payments, or a significant wave of defaults, which is even worse. Both are bad choices, but given the debt levels and the likely incomes, inflation's probably the more sustainable choice than a series of bankruptcies and defaults. So can we go to the next page? And so when you look at that across countries, this is going to be a huge deal. There are significant differences around the ability for governments to step in and help corporations and households who have been hit with this incredible suffering on many levels, but the economic suffering, and that's going to lead to huge differentials. And we think, and it's not clear any country, the U.S. or any country, is immune to this, that the social risk of this downturn in these global conditions, the odds that you have revolutions and those types of things are massively increased because you have one of the biggest economic hits with the negative backdrop to begin with. And that's all leading to this bubbling in the world and the huge differences. You have countries like the U.S. and Germany who can handle this well and to some degree offset the suffering, and they will still have huge problems. And then you have countries like Italy that has much less ability to spend money to do that, or even worse, Mexico and other countries. So you're going to see these huge differences because so much has to be done to resolve the problems caused by these losses, and there's such a range of ability and willingness to do that across the world. Can we go to the next slide? So if you look at this, of what we think the growth outcomes are likely to be, they're massive, much more significant than 2008 in most cases. If you look at the growth impact we expect going forward, things like Mexico and Italy and Turkey, you're looking at economies down on a level basis, something like 23% from where they were in 2019. And then you have the opposite extreme, places that are where the virus is better under control, but still there's the global impact, still there is the hit to growth, that China and Korea and Australia, you have, you know, -3%, -5% type growth impacts. And that's accumulating the impact associated with the virus, but that's offset by what the government's ability to do quantitative easing and fiscal stimulus has been to create those overall outcomes. So the main point on this slide is huge, devastating economic impacts that are still even just becoming recognized because there's been so much focus appropriately on containing the virus. The understanding of the losses and the growth impacts will be kind of the things that will be the headlines going forward.
Mr. Jensen, it's John Russell again. I'm sorry for interrupting, but this is such a fascinating presentation. We feel like we're drinking water through a fire hose. Are the currencies beginning to see these impacts, various impacts across the countries?
Well, I think you will see more and more of that, and that's one thing to certainly be wary of going forward, as we think current, particularly with interest rates at zero, the release valve becomes the currency because the interest rate can't do as much. And you are seeing, if you look at what's driven currency movements since COVID, it's really been basically, if you look at the growth drag, how bad the virus has affected their economy, which is partially how bad the virus was there, how big the shutdowns were, but also what sectors they're in. The more you're in travel and leisure, or the more you're producing things along those lines, the worse hit you've been than if you're more on manufacturing. But if you do the sector breakdown, those growth hits, combine that with the ability to stimulate fiscally, and then consider how much money they've been printing, those variables do a good job of describing what's happening in the currency markets. And that's what we think is, you know, driving it, and that you're going to see more and more of that going forward as some economies start to rebound and other economies continue to stay significantly depressed. You should expect, in our view, significant currency volatility going forward. So if we can go forward to the next page, and please feel free, I appreciate you or anybody asking questions as we go, because I want to be as helpful as possible. So please feel free to interrupt. And we'll also have some time at the end for any questions on the whole thing. So part of the world here is, and something we've certainly studied for a long time, we started thinking about quantitative easing in 2001, well before the global financial crisis, because we knew interest rates then got down to 1.5%. We knew that you would, when interest rates got to zero, that you would end up with quantitative easing. That was the lesson of the 1930s. And we think the logical next step when interest rates hit zero is Fed printing money and buying assets. Now you go through this environment and it's everywhere. So you went in the financial crisis, the United States, Europe, and Japan did quantitative easing in the UK, but other countries very modestly so. Today, it's across many, many countries. This chart shows quantitative easing is happening everywhere, and it's happening greater than the financial crisis everywhere but Japan. So such a massive amount of money printing and buying of assets, understanding where that money is going, who's getting it, what they're doing with it, is really what's driving markets. So if you look at today, it's this, the fact that the central banks are buying assets from other asset holders who are then buying equities and also other risky assets. That's why you're having this elevation of the equity market, because central banks were able to close the hole in financial markets, but they haven't been able to close the hole in the real economy. You can print money and buy assets. That's relatively easy for the central bank. You can't make up for closed restaurants and so on. So what you have is one of the most significant deviations between the financial market and the real economy. Now, that's setting up a risky situation. The Fed could do that, and in some ways it was good to do that because it took one more negative off, the wealth effect negative of bad asset prices. All the things that happen when you have low asset prices would have been another negative when you have plenty of negatives to deal with. But in the end, asset prices, companies can only be worth the future value of their earnings. And the more difference there is between the likely future value of earnings and the economy and the markets, the bigger risks that imply. And so it's something to consider, because right now you've got two different holes, even though they're related, a financial market hole that the Fed has – the central banks have been closed, and a real economy hole that has not been closed. And understanding those developments of, A, how much QE is likely to be done, where will the money go, that's what's driving asset prices, so you have to understand it through that lens, and then also understand the long-term unsustainability of that condition that will either be reconciled by asset prices declining to the real economy or the nominal real economy catching up to the asset prices, which we would think the likely path to that. It's hard to get the real economy there very quickly, but nominal economy could get there through inflation. So those are things to be considering. Can we go to the next slide? And just before I go back to the portfolio implications and the U.S., it's also worth considering what's happening in Europe, because unlike the U.S. came into the pandemic in relatively good economic shape. The unemployment was relatively low. There were huge differences in terms of wealth, and so certainly big underlying problems. But the overall situation at the macro level on average was pretty good. Now, there's countries in Europe where that really wasn't the case. If you take Italy, the top right, the level of incomes in Italy still hadn't recovered to the 2008 level. So they'd had a lost decade coming into this. And the virus hit Italy particularly hard economically as well as on a health basis, such that we've had GDP in Italy drop to levels that haven't been seen since the 1980s. Massive hit. Now, in the short term, because everybody's focused on fighting the virus, this isn't the highest concern. Longer term, these conditions and the problem it's causing for bankruptcies of small businesses in Italy and a banking sector that's already quite weak is going to lead to a sustained, significant depression in Italy. And this leads to a huge problem for Europe. Either they have to converge fiscally. Germany's got to step in and allow for a massive rebuilding of Italy and Spain. Or you're going to see such bad social outcomes that you're likely to see more and more divisiveness. So something extreme one way or the other either towards union or towards disunion is going to be necessary in our view in Europe. Let's move forward. Can we go to the next page?
Yeah. Hey, Greg, if I could jump in with a quick question. This is Rex Kim. So in listening to what you're saying, it reminds me of the picture and many of the discussions we were having back in 2011, early part of 2012. And if we think about sort of the outcome of all of that, we saw a continued run-up in asset prices for the U.S. with the rest of the world lagging. Does Bridgewater see a similar level of relative returns going forward?
No, I think if you look at the difference, so a couple of things to highlight in the difference here. So first off, let me compare this Europe situation to their 2011 situation. So if you take 2011, you did get this radical change in Europe in 2011 that allowed a situation that could have easily led to division to be sustained because Draghi took the step of whatever it takes on monetary policy, we're going to do it. And that was a big step. That was not an obvious step. A lot of different central bankers might not have done that. And that allowed them to get through. And you could see the hit, the economic hit going into 2011 here. And that allowed Italy and Spain and others not to default on their debt. And without that, you would have had a division of Italy now. Now, monetary policy has reached its basic extreme in Europe. And it has to be a fiscal movement that is as extreme as Draghi did on the monetary side. And so that's a question. And when you look at fiscal policy in Europe, the problem is, unlike the central bank, where the central bankers on essentially a weighted majority vote can decide what to do, fiscal policy actually requires almost unanimous support in Europe. So it's much more difficult, and they need a step similar to what Draghi did on the fiscal side going forward. So we'll see, that's going to be very difficult to maintain. Now, on your question of whether the U.S. assets will continue to outperform, we think the things that are difficult here for that is that U.S. assets pricing are so radically higher than the rest of the world's pricing. So they're pricing in a scenario of U.S. domination in terms of earnings, which COVID has to some extent accelerated as well, because the benefits of technology, the market share going to technology, that's all strongly benefited the U.S., but it's also now priced in an extreme way. And when you look forward, the place where profit margins is probably most at risk is in the U.S., because you've had such an incredible environment for profit margins over the last, really over the last 40 years, but over the last 20 years in particular. Tax rates have come down everywhere for corporations. They went from about 45% as effective tax rate for corporates to 20% over the last 30 years. The interest rates have come down from, 11% to zero for corporations. The regulations on corporations, particularly in the U.S., have collapsed to basically nothing. And unionization, the power of the worker, because of globalization and other reasons, but have diminished massively. Most of those trends we think are at risk in the next decade. Taxes on corporates are not likely to get lower and probably get higher, both because the international loopholes are likely to go away and the U.S. move in the last Congress was probably the last move corporates can get in terms of lower taxes. So those trends are likely to hurt profit margins going forward. Regulation is likely to increase as profits have gotten more concentrated in fewer players. So all of those trends make the U.S. Significantly at risk, even though it's got the huge benefit of having the reserve currency status combined with essentially a government, one government that can deal with the whole country. So we think the U.S. is not great in terms of likely to outperform on net. And global diversification is very, very, very critical given the different levels of valuation and also given the different ways the virus is likely to play out and the outcomes. So we'd be pushing for probably more global diversification, certainly than people have needed in the last decade, because the challenges in the U.S. are large and the valuations are pricing in perfection in the U.S.
Thank you.
So I'll skip this page 10 if we could go to the next page. Yeah, and this is another thing to consider is just how wide the range of outcomes are, particularly in countries and areas where the where what will happen with the virus is less clear. There are certain places in Asia like Korea and Australia where the range around the virus is fairly tight because they've gotten it down to roughly zero and are managing it in a very significant way. And so more of the range around what happens will be a function of what happens in the rest of the world. And domestically, they'll probably be able to control the virus towards a point of vaccine. Maybe not, but probably. But then you have places like the United States where it's not clear that we're going to be able to contain the virus. We're going to go through it and probably have an extended period where it's a drag on economic growth, and a wide range around that, depending on what happens in the fall, how big a deal is the fact that we're doing much less social distancing, all of those types of questions. So these charts show the type of range that we think around growth over the next 12 months, which is huge. It's about in the U.S., we think about a 10% range on where GDP is likely to come out, depending on how the fiscal policy plays out, and most importantly, how the virus plays out. So when we're thinking about this, just being prepared for that wide range of possible outcomes and the implications of that is so important. Can we go to the next page? And so this chart shows, we were talking about the inflation picture, that you have, it's just a simple conceptual chart that if you took the 1960s through the 1970s, you had this big wave up in inflation. And then since 1980 and the shift in monetary policy with Paul Volcker, you've had massive disinflation. The disinflation's come as a result of monetary policy focused on managing inflation, B, globalization, C, technology, and D, higher and higher debt levels that themselves are disinflationary. Those are the four big trends that cause this inflation decline. And as you go forward, we think the global trends are moving the other direction. Monetary policy is no longer super concerned about inflation. Fiscal policy combined with monetary policy is creating an aggregate demand that doesn't create aggregate supply. The globalization that's been a major disinflationary trend over the last 20 years is becoming less so, that we're moving from a world of interdependence to a world of independence. So everybody's got to rebuild their supply chains, and they're not necessarily rebuilding them in the most cost-efficient way. They're building them in the most resilient way, and that's a more expensive world that we're moving into. At the same time, you have these big budget deficits financed by money printing. So we do think you're likely, more likely than not, going to see a change in this major trend. Just as 1980 was a major turning point, we think essentially the movement to these policies, 2020 will be seen as a major turning point in inflation. But we'll see. You could imagine in some of the places where you can't do it that you end up with the deflationary pressures winning out and an even stronger wave down with all the risks inherent in that. But given the bankruptcies that would cause, we think policymakers will do everything they can to avoid that. So if we go to the final page here, next page, just when we think about that world and think about the very difficult shoes you face in investing well in this environment, our basic picture is it's never been more difficult to be an investor because cash gives you zero. So the risk-free rate's zero. You're not going to get anything from that. If you think about the returns on a portfolio, we break it into, there's two ways to make money. Three ways. Let's say there's the return on the risk-free rate, which is currently zero. There's holding assets, just holding a portfolio of assets and getting the benefit that you're taking on that risk. So just buying stocks and buying bonds, that kind of portfolio. When we look at the pricing, interest rates are obviously very low, so you know you're not going to get very much from bonds, almost nothing. And equities, A, price in that very low interest rate, and they're all the challenges for profits going forward. For so long, profits have grown faster than the economy. In the long term, that's unsustainable, and we do think we're probably at the turning point where where profits are going to have a hard time growing faster than the economy because the political environment's changing, the interest rate environment's no longer going to be beneficial, all of those types of things. So very difficult for equities to continue to significantly outperform the economy. So you're going to have much lower returns on equities, in our view, and much lower returns in bonds. So what can you do? Well, we think levers people should be considering is more environmental diversification. So while you can't use bonds to balance anymore because the interest rates are near zero, they can't go that much lower, although they could go negative. They can't go that much lower. They don't provide great diversification. But you can diversify with alternative assets, let's say like gold and inflation index bonds and other assets, to create more environmental diversification than just equities. And given the way policy is likely running, which is going to be more fiscal policy and more monetary policy, if that doesn't benefit the stock market, it will generally go into things that drive up inflation, making inflation index bonds more attractive than nominal bonds, or alternatives to the U.S. dollar, like gold and maybe other alternatives you could think about in terms of creating some diversification to the equities. So that's one thing, is getting enough diversification for different environments. Geographic diversification is another big deal. In some parts of the world, China and other parts of the world, you do have more regular interest rates. You have seen their assets create more balance, even in a situation that was awful for Chinese assets. If you take the trade war, then the virus, and the fact that they're still a significant exporter, yet a balanced portfolio in China has done fine because bond yields were able to balance what was going on in equity markets. And so thinking about geographies and where you can get balance is another thing we'd certainly be considering, and think in a more conflict-oriented world that will be a big deal. And then another thing that we think is really important to consider is stress testing. Thinking about this environment, if you do get a turn in inflation and the risk of a stagflationary environment, have you stress tested what that's like for your portfolio and what you could do about it? Those are all the steps we'd be really highly considering in your shoes about your overall portfolio. And then the second thing is, well, how can I create alpha in this environment better than just buying a passive portfolio? What kind of alpha is available? And the challenge is that alpha is very difficult, requires unique insight. So it's really hard, and it's mostly zero sum. And this is an unprecedented environment in some ways. So really, to make alpha in this environment, either you or whoever you hire really needs to understand the environment with the different linkages and all of these conditions. Now, the good thing is alpha has the potential to be uncorrelated and therefore add to a portfolio in a very significant way. It's just very difficult to achieve. So anyway, these are the choices, the levers to consider as you go forward. And we think more than ever, thinking about diversification is so critical. And that's why we think the movements that your organization has taken to really be on the cutting edge, I would say, of getting better diversification has been so critical, and hope you'll continue to move in that direction, because we think the next decade will be very different than the last decade, where all you had to do was, you know, hold U.S. equities passively and you were great. The odds that repeats, we think, are quite low, and that considering these levers really important. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions.
Any questions from council members?
Mr. Chair, I have one. Thank you for the really comprehensive and kind of wide-ranging conversation. I was struck by something you said and something you didn't say, so I want to try to combine them into one question. I was just thinking about stress testing was the thing you did say. The thing you didn't say so much about was specific sectors, and I was thinking about energy sector broadly. We've obviously seen a lot of volatility. I mean, laggards in oil and gas in recent years, but the tremendous volatility more recently, and then thinking about all of those other external factors that continue to play out, the declining costs of renewables, the challenges that the pandemic and COVID specifically are playing out as to how the economy works and how we organize ourselves and the way we work and that sort of stuff.
and then policy that might roll in on top of that. All those are big concerns. So I'm interested in how you think about that sector for portfolios like ours or funds like ours, both in the context of the stress testing and just how we ought to think about that.
Yeah, well, I think a couple of things. So the energy sector is unique in the in certain ways with respect to the changes that are going on, and certainly having that level of expertise to really understand is critical to security selection. And I don't have that level of expertise, so I can't speak to it in total. But I would say the good thing about those assets in your portfolio is they are providing a diversification that's necessary. Now, of course, things that provide diversification could do terribly. They did terribly when things were going well, and in that case, that's part of what happens when you buy diversifying assets. It doesn't mean they're all going to do well at the same time. And they certainly provide a diversification to a macro scenario that's possible, which in this case would be, let's say, an inflationary environment or a global conflict in which oil becomes a big deal. So I think though considering the aggregate portfolio, having an appropriate weight to those assets, I can't speak specifically to whether your weight is appropriate, but having some diversification, I believe, makes sense. And given all the unknowns in the world, that's where we would try to be headed and to judge things over relatively short periods, even 5 years or the last decade, we think can lead to bad decision making if you get rid of the worst performing assets, because often what you find, and I think it's pretty common, is the bad performing assets of last decade become the good performing assets in the next decade. So I wouldn't overweigh the recent performance, but definitely the consideration of how the world's changing with respect to energy is really important, and you can't necessarily rely on the history of oil's characteristics going into the future, given how many things have changed.
Thank you. Yeah, I was not asking for specifics for us, but just generally along the trends, and you got there to a large degree, so thank you.
Yeah, just even more generally, we think that sector diversification is so critical, right? If you go with the market cap weights on everything, you're going to end up super concentrated in a way that I don't think would make sense and create the right kind of balance in a portfolio going forward. So consideration of quality sector diversification as well as geographic diversification, really important.
Thank you.
Any other questions from council members or from Rex?
Go ahead, Rex.
No, please go ahead. Sorry about that.
This is Councilmember Kara Samples. I just have a question, and it's similar to the last question about the stress testing. On the environmental diversification, you talked specifically about commodities, gold, and, alternatives to the U.S. dollar. Could you provide any more detail there about, specific, whether it's alternatives or asset classes that might provide that environmental diversification?
Yeah, sure. So I'd say that the highlight items would be inflation index bonds, gold, and some commodity exposure, particularly as you think through the commodities that are getting used more and more. So that's one cut at it. The other thing I'd say is within the equity market, the sector diversification and the global diversification. So if you look at what happened, one of the studies that we've done, we can pass along, but if you look at when currencies, reserve currencies decline, which we do think is the inevitable for the U.S. dollar, which is, while it'll probably play out over a long period of time, it could play out faster, but the U.S. is using its reserve currency status in a massive way. That's why we can print money as much as we want to. Other countries have saved in the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. is able to print money at a rate that gets us more wealth than all the savings they've created on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. We can just, with a computer entry, get that. So the more you abuse your reserve currency status in that way, which I think, and on top of that, using it as a political power globally, what you're seeing is other countries start to look for ways to become the reserve currency, to shift in that direction. It's more and more a strategic priority of China to get off the dollar standard and find a way to do that. So when you think about, well, what are the alternatives? How does that play out? I think you also have to think about currency denomination and holding some of the global currencies that could become more reserve-like as well is another thing to consider. Basically, when you think about the virus and the overall outcomes, that Asian currencies and Asia in general as a little bit more stable in certain ways, obviously there's all the problems in terms of the growing conflict between the U.S. and China, but otherwise Asia has much less of the things that would concern you from a currency perspective, and the virus significantly more under control. Both of those things are worthy of consideration because that's another element of diversification that would be possible. And so, and from there, we continue to do more work on how you can create an equity portfolio that deals with this as well if you're stuck with equities. And we'll be doing more research and certainly sharing that with your organization as we do on how you can slice up the equity market to help with this as well. But so those are our thoughts. And certainly the main thing is to trigger thinking in your organization about steps you can take in that direction.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chair Russell, this is Rex Kim again. If I could ask one last question. Historically speaking, Greg, when we think about the all-weather strategy, unless I'm mistaken, I believe there is a history of using treasuries, various sort of portfolio of sovereigns in a levered basis. How is Bridgewater dealing with that type of portfolio construction given the low interest rate environment, and what other alternatives are you guys thinking about?
Well, we face this challenge just as you do now what do you do in a world of closer to zero interest rates where bonds don't create the nominal bonds don't create the diversification? And I think that largely what we're doing is A, recognizing that as part of our overall process. We still think the most important thing you could do in investing is recognize you could be very wrong about the world, and diversification is such a critical tool. So nominal bonds serve an element of diversification that they will serve much less well going forward. So how do you diversify? So our steps have been similar to what I've laid out here, which is, well, look at why were bonds such a good diversifier. One of the big reasons is that when things went bad, the central bank would lower the risk-free rate, which generally speaking would bring bond yields down, and you get the price effect of that. What's the equivalent of that in a world of monetary policy 3, where fiscal policy and quantitative easing combine together to offset downturns? Well, the equivalent of that is that either that money works and it leads to a reflationary equity boom, or it doesn't work and that money goes out and it leads to more inflation, so gold and inflation index bonds. So we've tilted the portfolio in a couple of ways. We've tilted it geographically towards places where you still have nominal bond yields that can fall. So that China is an example of that. The U.S. Bond yield is still higher than Europe and Japan, so it has more room to fall. And so there's a few bond markets where you still can get some balance. We've then shifted to make the balance associated with monetary policy 3 better, which means a little bit more on inflation index bonds and gold in that type of move. And overall, recognizing that beta is less good than normal, having less risk than normal. There's more risk in the world, and so having a little bit less risk in your portfolio than normal. Those are all the movements that have occurred in all weather with all to get at the same principles that we've always applied, which is given the environment, what's the best way to create a diversified portfolio, not to take alpha positions, but to get the most diversification you can. And so that's how we've been handling that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, Mr. Jensen, I think I can speak for everybody in this audience that we are very, very appreciative of your opinions. And as you said, it's, and I quote, never been more difficult to invest, which is why the council members and our chief investment officer have decided that with each meeting we need to seek out people like you. You're in rare company, believe me, who have a broad view of the global economy. So you're the first one, and I think, as I say, I think that your opinions are valued and valuable. So thank you again for taking your time.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Carl Cheng. And I understand Jason Element and Alan Emkin talking about asset allocation.
Great. Thank you, Chair Russell. For the record, Carl Cheng, Senior Investment Officer, Portfolio Risk and Research. That's a very hard act to follow, so we will try not to disappoint too much. So staff work with the Council's General Investment investment Consultant to update risk and return expectations for OPERF based on the consultant's capital market assumptions and the OIC-approved strategic asset allocation targets. While this update is presented annually, the numbers take a more prominent role during the odd number years, such as 2019 and 2021. That is because it coincides with the PERS Board's biannual setting of the assumed rate of investment return for the system, typically their July meeting of those years. While there is no requirement for the OIC's expected return for OPERF to match the assumed rate of return, Milliman, the actuarial firm retained by PERS, does consider the OIC-approved capital market assumptions when they make a recommendation. So I will just quickly wrap up this preamble with a preview of what's lined up. Jason Element from Callan will review their 2020 CMAs to steal a bit of his thunder. Due to a lowering of expected returns for the fixed income asset class, Callan projects OPERF's expected return to drop from 7.3% to 7.1%. After Jason's presentation, Alan Emkin will provide some closing thoughts, and then I will return afterwards for the OIC's consideration with a proposed revision to INV 1203, Statement of Investment Objective and Policy Framework for OPERF. If there are no questions at this time, I will turn it over to Jason.
Good morning. For the record, this is Jason Element with Callan. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes. Yes.
Excellent. So we have 30 minutes for this agenda item. So I will try to be pretty brief in getting through this material. Please stop me at any time if you have any questions. I'll also pause on a couple of pages to see if there's any questions at an appropriate time. We are, myself and my colleagues are on audio only. We don't have video. So I'll ask for the page to be turned or read out the master account page number from time to time to make sure that we're all on the same page. I do have the packet in front of me. So this is an asset allocation update. There's not a recommendation to change the asset allocation at this point. This is just an update based on our 2020 capital market assumptions. And so what I will do is briefly outline Callan's process for updating capital market assumptions and get to the expected return for the OPERF portfolio. And there's a few pages after that where we get into standard deviation correlations and the benefits of diversification. And that's just to, I think that's more educational in nature to make sure that we understand a lot of the metrics that we're looking at here. So with that, I will start on page 12, master page number 12, on Callan's process. So Callan reaches a consensus on the 10-year forward-looking capital market outlook every year towards the end of the year. And we are coming up with capital market assumptions for a broad array of asset classes that will feed into all the asset allocation studies we do in the year. And these assumptions are intended for long-term strategic planning. A couple of key words in there, long-term and strategic. When we go to change our capital market assumptions each year, we don't like to see them change by a significant amount. We want, because these are being used for long-term strategic planning, we don't want to go to our clients and suggest that they need to, you know, completely change over their portfolio year to year. This is not, trying to do tactical asset allocation here. So we developed our most recent set of assumptions, 2020, at the beginning of this year, before the crisis that we're currently in hit. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So the capital market assumptions, which we will soon see, for the next 10 years, and broadly, you know, how we come up with these assumptions is you can see on the slide there, in the first step, we're just evaluating the current environment, where are yields, inflation, valuations, and then we have an equilibrium, a long-term equilibrium of where we think the capital markets will go over the next 10 years. And so that journey is important, especially for bonds, but also for equities. And then we will do a lot of testing of those results to make sure that they work in an optimization framework, right? So that's a key step, actually, that calibration process, because as many of you probably know, the risk return and correlation inputs that go into an optimizer, the model can be very sensitive to just small changes in that. And that's another reason why we like to keep our long-term strategic planning assumptions pretty robust from year to year to the best of the ability we can. Carl just pointed out that, you know, in going from 19 to this year, we did reduce the expected return on the portfolio. That stemmed mainly from our bond return expectations, which we've lowered by 1%. So that's actually a pretty big move for us. We don't want to usually change our return expectations by 1% over 1 year, but we had to acknowledge where the yields were at and what was a reasonable expectation for bonds over the next 10 years. So next page, 13. These are the long-term expectations that for the next 10 years for the OPERF portfolio. Wherever you see OPERF benchmark, that means it's customized to the current structure in the OPERF portfolio. So underneath the hood there, you can see the footnotes in noting that we're recognizing some of the structural weightings that are underneath that at that asset class. And we're also, to some extent, recognizing the experience that the OPERF has had in private real estate and private equity to derive these assumptions. So the next three slides, I'm going to cruise through pretty quickly, and please stop me if there's some questions. What they do is give
a... Yeah, Mr. Elliman, it's John Russell. Let me ask you a question. I'm fascinated with inflation, and it was a big topic in the prior presentation. So inflation is the last on the list here. It has a pretty profound effect on, almost a benign effect on your assumptions, doesn't it?
By benign, meaning because it's a low?
Not a lot we can do about it in that respect. You don't invest in inflation.
We could hope that the real estate portfolio could provide some inflation protection, although it's more of an intermediate to long term type of inflation hedge. So over the very short term, I wouldn't expect it to maybe protect as well. So yeah, it is. I agree that definitely, and especially over the short term, it would be very difficult to hedge inflation. The best asset class would be TIPS, and even Treasury inflation protection securities are maybe 0.3, 0.4 correlated with inflation.
right, thank you.
So the next few slides are an abbreviated version of some of the underpinnings of our capital market assumptions starting on 14. We could easily spend a couple hours here fleshing out all the different moving parts and factors and models that we look at. But this is, I'll be very brief, just a couple, taking a couple minutes to give a flavor as to some of the important components that build, that are building blocks that build up to our capital market assumptions. So I think these are all pretty obvious, right? Real GDP over the long run, our inflation forecast, recognizing different geographical regions, of course, U.S. versus non-U.S. and emerging. What's not also important but not shown here is our yield forecast. So what is the forecast for treasury rates and spreads over the next 10 years? And we did anticipate that there would be some gradual rising in yields over the next 5 years. That was a bit that which helps with bond return expectations because although there's some capital losses incurred in those first few years, you're clipping a higher coupon in the later years. And so I would say, you know, if I were to look ahead when we revisit our capital market assumptions at the end of the year, you know, and then this is not a consensus in the group. This is my own opinion. I think the bond returns are probably the most likely to come down, just given where yields are at right now. Inflation is a tough one. I think we might hold at 225. Greg Jensen, the earlier speaker, did a great job of talking about deflation versus higher inflation, and I think from that you can understand that that's a tough one to pinpoint. And then with equities, I think they might stay the same, but there's a possibility that they might reduce there as well. And that would mainly probably be driven by a lower earnings growth forecast for the global economy. So moving to the next slide, this is a bit technical. I'm going to be brief. This is master page number 15. This is one equity model we employ, and I thought it was interesting to share just to because it does break out the components of how we get up to our equity return expectations and differentiates between U.S. and ex-U.S. You can see that the real earnings growth for broad U.S. equities is 2.5. Historically, that's, I think, going way back, I think that's a pretty good estimate, but looking forward the next 10 years, especially when we revisit these at the end of the year, I kind of wonder if we might have to lower that, but we will see. So moving on to bonds, I mentioned that we expected higher yields, and of course yields have come down. Rates have come down quite a bit year to date, while spreads are elevated. Here again, we're just sharing with you some of the components that build up to our bond return expectations. And so core fixed income is the key asset class that you have in your portfolio and how we got to 275. Given where yields are right now, 275 for the next 10 years seems kind of lofty. that's one of the numbers I suspect that we'll have to bring down and recognize. And to step back for a second, to be fair, you know, when we set the assumptions starting at 1/1/2020 and said we'd get 275 over 10 years, that's still very possible, right? Because the yields plummeting could mean an aggregate return of 5 to 6% in the first year. And if we lower to 250 for the next 10 years, then you'll get roughly 275 over the next 10 years. So I'm going to move off the capital market assumptions, the process, and this technical part.
Mr. Element?
Yes.
Mr. Element, John Russell again. But back on this prior slide, the global ex-U.S. equity, are those hedged back to the U.S. dollars?
No, they're not. And that's a good observation. When it comes to currency, we tend to be very benign, unless currency is very hard to predict, and so we don't typically have a view on a trend of a stronger dollar or weaker dollar over 10 years. So you don't see any currency component in there, meaning there's no effect due to currency. And over the long term, I think there's some empirical evidence to support that the expected return on currency is zero. So that's another factor that we consider. And then you notice the repricing return is zero. And again, this comes back to us, this being long-term expectations. Unless there's valuation that's more than a two-standard deviation event away from what we would consider a reasonable valuation, we're probably not going to have any kind of valuation adjustment in our long-term equity return expectations.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so on 17 is the OPERF portfolio. This is the long-term strategic asset allocation. And our expected return right now is 7.1% with a standard deviation of 12.4. I can tell you from my experience that for a public fund, the level of risk here is moderate. We see a lot of public funds that might have a volatility of 14 plus. So, achieving a pretty reasonable return expectation over the next 10 years. And a lot of that has to do with the vol being at 12.4. And we'll get into this in a bit. That risk level being where it is a lot to do with the very broad diversification that you have in your portfolio. Now, this other number, 7.2, I think, just to be sure we're on the same page, so this investment return assumption, that's also known as the actual discount rate. I believe Milliman uses that term to refer to their discount rate. So that's just the assumption that they're currently using to discount the benefit promises and to put a price tag on those liabilities. And it's usually pretty consistent. We do not want to see a huge gap there. I mean, it could be a problem, right? If our expected return is 5% and the actuary was saying you're going to get 7. So, but these are very close, obviously, right? It's only a 10 bip difference. So there's a pretty good alignment here. Any questions? Moving along is a on page 18. We have a illustration of discount rates across a broad universe. This is from NASRA. They put this together every year, and it's very helpful to see where public funds are in terms of setting that important discount rate, right? This is going to have a very big impact on the size of the liability, and it serves as a return bogey for the plan sponsor, right? You want to achieve that 7.2% in order to avoid investment losses that will make it harder to fund those promises over the long run. And we're very close right now at 7.1. And it's very close to the median of the public fund universe. So you're pretty much in line with the median right now of 7.25%. So all is good on this front in terms of the expected return and the discount rate. Any questions? I'm going to move forward to the next page. This is 19. And I believe these next few pages, at least the next three, are more educational in nature. Just to make sure that we interpret these capital market assumptions correctly. So standard deviation, I think we all know, is a measure of dispersion, how the return can vary over 1 year or 10 years. This is showing U.S. broad equity over 1 year. And there's a rule in statistics you might have heard of, the 68, 95, 99.7. We like this rule because it gives you a good understanding of the variability that comes with some of these asset class exposures. Something like equities are obviously volatile. How volatile are they? Well, we can only be 68% confident that equities will return minus 11 to plus 25 over the next year. So that's a very broad range, right? And only having 68% confidence. So when we saw the return estimates earlier, they were point, we call those point estimates. It's the, you know, the median of a broad distribution. And of course, if we looked at bonds, we'd see a much more narrow dispersion. It wouldn't be quite as wide. So with that, that's a nice segue into the next page, page 20, which shows the Callan's return expectations for some of your asset class exposures over the next 10 years. So these are over 10 years now. And you can see that, you know, private equity is very volatile. Look at a lot of dispersion, high volatility. And then U.S. fixed income, you know, much more lower volatility, provides ballast to the portfolio and good diversification. And you can see it's got a more tighter range term. Moving to the next page are correlations. And correlations, of course, vary from minus one to plus one. We like correlations that are low positive or negative if it's possible, because that means we're getting good diversification, right? So when one asks, when equities go up, bonds may come down. You see minus 0.11 there. It's not a strong negative number, but we think that it'll probably, it still could provide some diversification going forward. That's your strongest diversifier. The diversifying strategies, aptly named, are also a good asset class, is another portion of the portfolio that we believe can provide very good diversification for the portfolio because it's a low positive. So that means that it might move in the same direction as equities, but it's a weak correlation, so it may not. And then I'll just do one more page before I pause, because it's a nice segue into this waterfall chart on page 22. And what this is conveying is the benefits of diversification. So each asset class exposure illustrates the contribution to risk in the portfolio. So a lot of risk is being contributed from equities, right? Public equity, 6%, private equity, 4.6. So each asset class is contributing. Parity is very little. U.S. fixed income is small. But then there's, when we take into consideration the correlations, we get this diversification benefit. And so that's why we call it a waterfall, because now the total volatility is coming down to the net volatility, and we get back to our 12.4% number that we saw earlier. And I'll pause there in case there's any questions. Having heard none, I'll move forward and move to the last couple slides here. And this is this page, this graph on page 23 is showing how the equity beta has showing the level of equity beta over the last 12 years. Well, I guess it goes back to 2002, so we're talking 18 years here. In the last crisis, the global financial crisis, GFC, the portfolio was riskier. It had a higher amount of equity beta going in. During this crisis that we're in right now, because of de-risking on a lot of different fronts and broader diversification of the portfolio, the equity beta today for the old proof is lower. And then finally, last page. And this is something I think that was brought up in an earlier meeting, and it's worth repeating that, you know, the OPERF is not going to look like other public funds. And the reason for that is because of the private market investments, the private equity and private real estate. That's a big chunk of the portfolio. It's a very important piece. We expect really good sharp or risk-adjusted performance from those private markets. They also go through appraisal smoothly, right? So every quarter there's an appraisal valuation, and there's a lag there for these private markets to catch up with the public markets, which traded daily. So relative performance to other public funds is probably going to look a lot different. And what that's going to mean in terms of private markets catching up is that in good times, yield proof is going to lag. It's going to be not quite as high a return. But in down periods, like what we just saw in the first quarter of this year, you're going to see better performance. Now, that appraisal smoothing valuation means that there's been some losses that occurred that just haven't been recognized yet. So we will know in the next two or three quarters a better feel for the return going through this crisis, maybe longer. It's important to point out the difference between absolute and relative performance. So when you're comparing to other public funds, the yield proof is most likely, especially during volatile times, the yield proof is probably going to look different on a quarterly or annual basis. And that concludes my remarks on the asset allocation update. I will pause there for any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Elliman? Good. Please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, this is Alan Emkin. I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Yes.
Great. First, I hope everyone is healthy and safe. We are living through some very challenging times, and that includes, believe it or not, establishing capital market assumptions. And the difference between this presentation and Mr. Jensen is marked, and I just think it's important to recognize that smart and reasonable people can come up with very, very different opinions. You manage the assets for the retirement plan, and they have a liability side, and there's pretty good estimates of the future cost on the liability side. So the liability side has a lot of precision. That's not the case on the investment side. There's a huge dispersion that can occur, and that historically has occurred. And just to give you a quote, Peter Bernstein, someone we in the investing community look at as a great thinker, said forecasts create the mirage that the future is knowable. Sadly, no one knows what the future will be. But that being said, the assumptions that Callan presented to you and that the staff presented are reasonable given the facts and circumstances that existed at the beginning of the year. And as we indicated, they will change as the markets change. But it is a challenge, and it's very important to keep in mind that getting those numbers correct is a difficult thing, but those numbers are reasonable for the purposes they're being used. And I'll close with another quote. It is far better to foresee even without certainty than not to foresee at all. And so going through this planning process is really good policy, it's best practices, and it's thoughtful and reasonable. And I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Alan?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Treasurer?
Tobias Reed. Mr. Emkin, you're always a good source for us of broader perspective and history and so on. So I'm interested in this context of assumptions. I'm certainly not the first person to observe, nor the most eloquent, the increasing disconnect between what seems to be happening in the markets and the real economy. And I wonder if you could comment on that and offer us any advice on how we should think about that.
Mr. Treasurer, thank you. I would look to the comments of Mr. Jensen as being very insightful. There are enormous headwinds globally for the capital markets. And in light of that, it's hard to explain why the equity market is rallying to the extent that it is. In my opinion, it's a triumph of hope over experience. But the reality is, for most investors, investing in fixed income and cash offers such a little opportunity. In fact, you have negative real rates of return when you adjust for inflation for 10-year treasury bonds. So it's almost counterintuitive to want to hold those assets, and there aren't that many other places for it to go. And so the easiest place to put the money is in the equity market, which currently is offering a dividend which is greater than the yield on the bonds, and money is flowing in that direction, and an enormous amount of liquidity has been created by both fiscal and monetary policy. At some point, we don't know when, there has to be an intersection between the financial economy and the Wall and the Main Street economy. And when that happens, I think you're going to see some carnage in the equity market. So I hope that answers your question.
It helps. Thank you.
Other questions of Alan? Hearing none, thank you very much. And Carl, back to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Russell. Again, just the staff is recommending a revision to policy INV 1203. And you obviously have already seen the changes. So just really broadly, there are three groups of changes. One, updating the capital market assumptions. Those are numbers provided by the council's general investment consultant. And so we're asking for your approval to do just updated policy for those numbers. Two, updating the text specifically for the asset class portfolios that were approved at previous OIC meetings, such as changes to the fixed income portfolio and the risk parity portfolio. And finally, streamlining this policy by removing the alpha target at the fund level. There are alpha targets for the specific, the excess return targets for the specific asset class portfolios are still retained in those policies, those asset class portfolio policies, but there were concerns about possibly confusion to have an alpha target for the total fund level, given that that might not be applicable. So staff is just recommending removing table two.
Carlos, John Russell again. There are other changes in the policy than the numbers. Any questions of council members about those changes? If not, I would entertain a motion to accept the new policy.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the revisions to the policy as presented.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
This is Patricia. I'll second.
Good. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 I heard four ayes, so thank you. Okay, the next on the program is Jeff Nolan.
All right. Good morning, Chair Russell, members of the council. For the record, this is Jeff Nolan, Senior Investment Officer for Fixed Income. If you could pull up the presentation and go to page 3, entitled Agenda Overview. So during today's presentation, as part of the realignment of the fixed income portfolio that was approved last December, I'm going to walk you through our manager selections for Global Sovereign and EMD, which is the first leg of the realignment. We've broken down the presentation into three parts. First is just a brief refresher of what was approved. The second part is how did we get from the approval to where we are today? And the third part is our manager recommendations for your approval. If you could turn to the next page, please. Going back a little bit further, back in late 2018, the team was given a blank piece of paper, really with the goal of building, for lack of a better way of saying it, a mousetrap that more closely aligns the portfolio with the fixed income goals and objectives. We were intellectually honest about how we went about it. We had no preconceived notions, so we threw every asset class into the mix, and through various iterations, we knocked out things that we didn't think were fits, like private equity or local currency EMD. Now, I am not going to page flip through this entire presentation, but I'll just skip to certain pages and, you know, do a couple of call-outs on each one. We could turn to, oh, we're already on the next page, page 5. Really, the key point here is fixed income's role, and that's what I wanted to highlight. Here, the goal of fixed income is diversification to the overall plan equity, and in particular to the public equity portfolios, as well as really providing liquidity for OPERF's cash needs. I mean, if we could put it into like a baseball analogy, because I don't know anything about music like Mr. Shervin did, I mean, fixed income's role is really, we're bunts and singles. That's our job. We are not swinging for the fences. That's not what we're here to do. And so the goal of the review was really to further enhance the diversification and liquidity that we had. So we worked with BlackRock on the modeling, and then we had both Cowen and Guggenheim do an independent review of the work that we did, really to minimize the chance that we were a bunch of gleeful lemmings, you know, unwittingly driving over the cliff, having missed something. So if we could turn to page 7, please. This page is the roadmap of what we're doing. Thematically, we are further de-risking the portfolio to enhance diversification and liquidity. This is going to be the third iteration of it. And how are we doing that? Really, a couple of big areas. We're reducing credit exposure. We're increasing our treasury exposure. We are, as we're talking about today, we've added a sleeve of global sovereigns, and then we are going to be creating what we call an OPERF liquidity fund. And if we could now turn to page 10, please. So this was actually what was approved last December, and it was Target Portfolio 2, which you can see two pages on. We were given permission to add a modest amount of leverage, 12.5% at the asset class level, 2.5% at the plan level, with the ability under certain circumstances to take that leverage up to 25% at the asset class level, and those subject to dual sign-off. Those details of the constraints are in the appendix if you want to refer to them. And if we turn to page 12, please. Now, this is a bit of an eye chart, and I'm not going to go through it, but really this is in here just to show you the asset allocation for fixed income that was approved with the leverage. It's in the blue box in the middle. And then on the right, those are some of the themes that I had touched on, dropping credit, exposure, increasing treasuries, et cetera. If we could turn now to page 14. So with that as background, how did we get here? Shortly after the approval was provided in December of 2019, we kicked off manager searches. So the process is fairly straightforward, and it's been laid out here on the page. I won't walk you through it. We did review all the managers with Cowen, and you know what I do want to call out is really the focus of our due diligence was really on the portfolio management and philosophy and process and risk management and ops operations. You know, we were looking for managers who could clearly articulate how they think, what their framework was, how does an idea. You know, what's the catalyst behind an idea, and how does it work its way through the system and get into a portfolio, and then also on the reverse, if a mistake has been made, you know, how does it get out? Now, clearly during the first quarter, as everyone is well aware, we had some very severe market disruptions where pretty much every asset class, but for maybe treasuries and a few others, were severely disrupted. As part of this process, while we're cognizant of the drawdowns that we saw across asset classes in the first quarter, you know, we've tended to put much more emphasis on, you know, pre-first quarter results. And because we are long-term investors, we're looking out 10 years, 15 years. And so, you know, we weren't surprised by some of the drawdowns that we saw across the markets. Now, as a result of that disruption, we have at least temporarily put the realignment on hold. We're continuing the manager searches, but actually moving cash around and either defunding portfolios to fund new ones. We're going to sit tight until we see that we have a more stable outlook. So if we could turn to page 16, please. So with that as context, i.e. what was approved, the background behind it, how did we get here? Here are our recommendations for consideration for approval by the council.
Jeff, John Russell again. Let me ask you to go back to the search process.
Sure.
As the head of the real estate committee, I was asked to participate in a search process, a selection process for a consultant, and I was very, very impressed with how well it was run. It was actually run by somebody not on our staff. There's a function, I think, within the state that makes sure that the searches are all done
procurement
in a kosher manner. But it was a fascinating process, and probably 12, 15 of us were present. A lot of brainstorming back and forth. The vote of that group was not the final vote by any means, but I think the whole process of doing that was, I think everybody won. Is that the sort of process that was used in this instance?
No, we did not. We are not required to use a third party to do the selection process. We're allowed to run it ourselves. But so we had a small team of approximately four or five people from the fixed income team who were running the process. But along the way, we did, you know, as we started to shortlist managers, we did, you know, circle up with Callan to get their views. And we also had Callan independently run some manager searches as well. And we each went through our pros and cons of each manager. But, yeah, but we did not utilize a third party.
Well, again, this is a personal view, and Rex, you may have a different view. I would hope that a council member would be present for some of those meetings.
I think that's probably a broader governance discussion. Per policy, I think the OIC sets policy and the investment division executes upon that policy.
Right.
So it's definitely a discussion we can have. But
yeah, and that was the circumstance with the real estate committee. But I think the brainstorming was, I think, valuable for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Jeff, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So on page 16, so on the global sovereign mandate, we have selected for your approval Morgan Stanley Investment Management and PIMCO with an allocation of up to 8.1% of fixed income AUM split evenly between the two managers. This is going to be a mandate that's going to be hedged back to dollars, so we're not taking any FX risk here. On the EMD side, we selected three managers, Global Evolution, which is a boutique EM manager out of Denmark, Ashmore, which is a very large EM manager out of London, and then PGIM out of New Jersey. The allocation there is up to 2.7% of fixed income AUM, again, split evenly amongst the three managers. This is going to be a hard dollar EM mandate with minimal FX risk here. So with that, I would make a recommendation to approve these managers, or if you have other questions.
Other questions? Is there a motion to approve the staff recommendation?
Chair, I so move.
Is there a second?
This is Member Samples. I second.
Been moved and seconded to approve the staff recommendation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 I heard four ayes. All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ralph.
So, Rex, next on the agenda is you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Chair Russell. Hopefully all of you could see the screen right now. I'm on the asset allocation for OPERF, SAFE, and Common School Fund. The one thing that I did want to call out for the Common School Fund is you will see that the global equity portfolio is slightly underweight and is actually underweight the policy range. The fixed income portfolio is slightly overweight target, but is within range. But so I did want to point that out since the global equity portfolio is slightly below range and provide a bit of explanation, backstory there. Very briefly, what is happening there is that there was a manager termination in that portion of the portfolio, and the allocation to the new manager, the timing of that is happening at the end of this month. So in other words, there was a short period of time in which that was a bit of a lag between redeeming from a manager and putting that capital to work with a new manager. Long way of saying, based on current plans, the Common School Fund will be back to target at the end of this month, but I did want to point that out.
Thank you.
This next page is really sort of the same as the prior page, but in more graphical manner. And then the next few pages are the NAVs for OPERF. Looking at the very far right side there, you know, you'll see the drawdown we've all been discussing and witnessing, but really there's been a really nice pickup in performance over the last couple months. And that same pattern exists for the various other portfolios as well. And then the very last item for me is the 2020 and 21 forward calendar. We've got a very busy year ahead for us, and we are working hard as staff to get us properly prepared. So with that, Chair Russell, I will turn it back to you.
Well, this is time for open discussion among staff and council members, and consultants for that matter.
Mr. Chair, something for the council, and I guess for Mr. Kim as well. And we heard a lot of interesting things today, a lot for all of us to think about and process, obviously, and the world keeps changing and rapid and unprecedented, even though that's an overused word sometimes, unprecedented ways. As evidenced by my question, I've been thinking a lot about what the world is going to look like and how that impacts our portfolio when we get to some level of stability. I think there are going to be things we look back at through this period and say that was a turning point. Tons of examples of that. My head has been thinking particularly around the environment, around oil and gas, and feeling like we don't have the visibility on how that plays out inside our portfolio that I think we could and should have. There's obviously a lot of ways to manage that risk, probably opportunities in that as well, and obviously a lot of different ways to take that question on. So I'm hopeful that the council will recognize and agree with me about that as something we should know more about. And I want to ask Rex and the team whether you could help us think through how that would how that could play out, how we could get our hands and minds around that in a more useful way, and we can come back with some recommendations about how we might be able to do that.
You know, as evidence of that, if I may, John Russell, there's been a profusion of funds that they don't divest, but they exclude, and the S&P excluding oil and gas for the first couple months of the virus was greatly advantaged.
I think you make an interesting point. I mean, that I think just underscores the idea that there are so many different approaches, and there are probably advantages and disadvantages to each of those. But for us to take that on in a deliberate way is really appealing to me, to take on the discussion, that is.
Chair Russell, Kevin Olenek here. Just to sort of come back to the capital market assumptions, as Carl noted, the PERS board and Milliman, our actuary, take into account the capital market assumptions as we set our liabilities and our assumed rate of return. And the next year, the 2021 assumptions are obviously more important because they really do feed into the actuarial assumptions that we use for the following set of actuarial valuations. But just a note that I will be bringing the capital market assumption update that was discussed this morning to the July PERS board meeting.
Yes, we are well aware of that. Any other comments?
This is Member Samples. I just wanted to mention how much I appreciated having the remarks from Greg Jensen from Bridgewater. I think that's helpful for the council, especially in the current environment, and I wanted to thank you all for putting that together. Thank Greg for being here and suggest that doing similar things and having similar speakers in future meetings may be also beneficial.
And this is Member Moss. Kara, thank you. You took the words right out of my mouth and probably expressed them more eloquently, but that is exactly the observation I was going to make too, so thank you.
Jensen's going to be a hard act to follow, Rex, but we're looking forward to somebody of his caliber at each of the meetings, in the subsequent meetings.
I think I was able to pull a very, I would say, pretty remarkable list from staff. I think one of the values that we have as a state is really the strong reputation that we have, the very strong relationships with managers that we have, and really the willingness of a lot of these managers to be with us, help us think through some of these larger issues. So I've got a spreadsheet of names. So
good. Good.
Now that we're expert at teams, they don't have to travel either. So,
yeah.
Advantage.
So we're in good hands in that regard then.
I think so.
Good. Good. Any other comments from anybody else in the audience? And the public comment, I think, is in this environment is very difficult, isn't it? People would have had to have applied for the right to speak correctly. Is that correct?
So the way we will be doing it, at least for now, and of course if there are suggestions, we would love to hear those suggestions. But as of now, public comments would need to be submitted via writing. Those who wish to make their comments could do it during the meeting via the Q&A portion of the team's application, or they could send it via email or regular mail to Treasury.
But for this meeting, we haven't had any requests?
We have not.
Unless there's further discussion, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Mr. Chair, I move to adjourn.
Is there a second? I'll second it. All those in favor of adjourn, please signify by saying aye.
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 All four. Good. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.